This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission, which is made up of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, is putting together a report and will submit it to the Indiana General Assembly soon as a result of the 10 public hearings that they have held during the recent months. To tell us more about the report, which has just come out this morning, we have Julia Vaughn. Her job mainly is the Policy Director for Common Cause Indiana, but she is also representing other organizations, including the Redistricting Commission, on this. Julia, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Will you tell us a little bit about the report that the Redistricting Commission has put together and they've just released today?
Sure. It is the product of 10 public hearings and really a voice from across Indiana. We talk to people who are very different in places across our state that are very different, but the themes we heard were recurring and consistent. Number one, people think we need to have more competition in Indiana elections. We heard over and over again from voters that they don't feel heard in the political process because the lines, where the lines were drawn 10 years ago, has more of an impact on the outcome of elections than voters do. And I think that really contributes to low voter participation here in Indiana. We have, for the past decade, ranked in the bottom 10 of all states for voter turnout. So we think drawing districts with an eye towards competition will really improve a lot of things civically here in Indiana, in particular voter turnout. But we can't, you know, it is difficult to draw districts with the sole purpose of making them competitive because of the way people are grouped together throughout our state. And so our recommendation is not to just blindly draw districts that seek to increase competition. We think you can do this organically by paying more attention to communities of interest. We heard over and over again from people, again, all across the state, that their communities are divided, or they're put in a district with another community that's radically different from them, that has other interests and concerns in the General Assembly or in Congress. So they clash. And when you have districts like that, there's always going to be a great group of people who end up really disappointed because there's no way a legislator can adequately represent these very different kinds of communities that are grouped together in the same district. So our report asks legislators to engage in a transparent and open process, that's the third recommendation, that seeks to recognize where important communities of interest are in our state and keep them intact for purposes of redistricting. Don't divide these communities, because that's how people end up feeling their voice is not heard in the political process. And then as an extension on that, going beyond communities of interest, we heard story after story of towns, cities, counties that are divided in ways that are illogical. For example, the town of Kokomo is divided into two different congressional districts when it would easily fit inside one. So that's confusing for voters down in Kokomo. And again, it makes it difficult for that community to really exercise its political clout as a community because it's divided into two different districts. So we hope this report will provide a roadmap that the legislators will choose to take as they begin the process of drawing new districts for Congress and state legislature. That's going to happen some months from now. So another recommendation that we have is that the legislature tell us, number one, when are you going to come back to Indianapolis to really get down to the nitty-gritty of map drawing, and how will the public be included in this process? We've got a public mapping website. We're going to have a competition and encourage people to give their ideas on redistricting that way. And we hope the legislature will encourage citizens to utilize that and take the input that they're given through these maps submitted by the public and perhaps choose one of those to pass into law instead of one that is drawn only by legislators. And, you know, in our process, because we have Republicans dominating the state house, it would be a very one-sided process. So our group is multi-partisan. We've been doing things in a public and transparent way. And we hope that they'll not only listen to the recommendations that we outline in our report, but also model the process that we've been undergoing, because we've found that Hoosiers are very interested and eager to take part in this conversation.
I know that Indiana is made up of course, both rural and urban districts. It just seems, though, that if you take a look at the map, that the communities that are usually categorized as rural or urban just don't happen to be close together in many cases. You're spread out across the state. Some regions are merely urban, and some are merely just rural. That one of the points that got brought out in many of the public meetings that came about, that you hope that lawmakers will take into account?
More the opposite. What we heard from people, again, all across the state, were districts where those types of very different communities were combined. For example, Senate District 28, which is down here in Marion County, the bulk of the district geographically is in two rural counties, Hancock and Shelby. But there's this strange, skinny little finger that comes out to the west, and it comes into Marion County and incorporates this really big chunk of Warren Township, which is a very urban part of our community. And so the state senator who represents this district is from Greenfield, small town in the rural part of the district. And we heard from people in the Indianapolis portion of the district that they really felt unrepresented, because on issues like mass transit, for example, Senator Kreider had voted against their interests. And so over the past decade, they found it very hard to make their voices heard in the Indiana State Senate, because their legislator comes from a very different kind of community, and they've had difficulty making him understand their issues. So, you know, again, that's another point where we can avoid dividing communities of interest or grouping them in a district where another community is going to have radically different opinions. We should strive to do that. Again, people are just feeling very unheard in the political process because of how these lines were drawn 10 years ago. And I think it's really impacting civic participation in a negative way.
Julia, I know that you had an opportunity, of course, to meet with the commission members. We have three of them from Northwest Indiana. We have former LaPorte Mayor Lee Morris, who we have had on our election night coverage several times. So we know what type of person he is. He's a Republican. Misty Summers Kemp is a Democrat. She's from Portage. Christopher Brandon Harris, I guess, represents the independents stand on the commission. He's from Hammond. Did some of the members of the commission get together and discussing things after the public meetings that all came together in the report?
Yes, we have not had any sort of regional factions, but certainly the Northwest Indiana part of our state is very well represented. You've got all three categories of our commission members covered, and Missy and Lee and Chris are just doing a fantastic job. But yeah, we've come together, and you know, I'll tell you, I'm the person who had the primary job of writing the first draft of our report, and that one is not the one that got delivered to the legislature. We had quite a bit of discussion, and the members of the commission were really adamant that while, you know, we're considering the advice of redistricting experts, legal experts, people who, you know, this is their field, this is their area of expertise, and that's important to keep in mind. But really, this report is a voice from the grassroots. It's what Hoosiers are thinking about the current districts, the problems that they see having arisen from those districts, and the corrections that they'd like to see made this time around. So we hope that this is a roadmap that the legislature will use. The next step is we're encouraging our activists to take this report to their legislators. You know, send them an email, attach it, and say, I'd like you to read this, and hopefully we can get together, you know, maybe virtually or get together in the community, have a cup of coffee, and talk about this. Because I think, you know, we found that most legislators just don't have a very good grasp on the issue. I mean, quite frankly, many of the ones who are in the State House today weren't around 10 years ago. So we can't expect them to be experts on redistricting. So we really want folks to take this document and start talking to policymakers about it. That's the one really good thing about the delays that the pandemic forced on the census. You know, we have many months that we can talk to the legislature about this, that they can really take the temperature of the public on this issue and get it right from a communities of interest perspective. So we hope this document will help facilitate those kinds of conversations going on all across Indiana, and that when the House and Senate Elections Committee gets to work, which, again, that's one of our requests, that they get busy soon. You know, they don't need to wait for census data to start taking public testimony on redistricting. They should start these conversations soon, and hopefully the report that we've put together will help guide those conversations and that we can get new district maps for Congress, for state legislature, that work for voters and communities all across Indiana.
Let me ask you, Julia, here in kind of closing our conversation today, sort of a two-part question. In your view, how do you think the report turned out? And secondly, do you think that lawmakers will be able to follow the report and do the things that you and the commission members would like happen?
I'm very pleased with how it turned out. I think we not only report out what the public had to say, but we give the legislature some very practical recommendations how to make those desires come true. For example, you know, one of the excuses we've always heard about dividing communities of interest or towns illogically is that, well, we had to do that because you have to have districts that are almost exactly equal in population. That is true for the congressional districts, but it's not true for state legislative districts. And in fact, the courts have allowed some fairly significant deviations in population if your goal is to preserve a community of interest. So, you know, I'm very pleased that we've not only set out this is what you should do, but we've given recommendations, okay, this is how you achieve these goals. So I think the report is really good, and I think it turned out well, and that was because of the input from all of our commissioners. They're a very diverse group of people, and I think when you include a diverse group of people in the conversation, you're always going to end up with a report that is better than if it's just, you know, a handful of people who all think the same. So I'm really gratified by the input from the commission members. And, you know, I'm optimistic. I mean, I think the legislature understands that we're at a very different place this year than we were 10 years ago. There is much more public interest in this issue. We also have the ability with technology to analyze their maps very quickly and point out where they might be missing the mark. And I think they understand that. So there are going to be unprecedented levels of public scrutiny around the process this time, and also with the end product, with the districts that are proposed. So, you know, we're reaching out to the legislature and saying, you know, this is a really diverse group of people that have done a lot of, put a lot of thought into this issue, and we're here to help. And so I'm hopeful that with that spirit of cooperation, we can all work together and end up with districts, again, that serve the interest of voters and communities across Indiana.
Well, Julia, with that, we say thank you very much for spending time reporting to us the results of the report that the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission has put together, and we'll turn over to the General Assembly very soon. And we hope that the redistricting work that does happen later this year turns out to be satisfactory to as many people as possible. And thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. John Seibert is the executive director of Valparaiso's City Parks and Recreation System, and he is with us to bring us up to date not only about the park system in general around the city, but some will look ahead as we go into the nice weather months and the rest of 2021. And John, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Will you give us first, I guess you could call the elevator speech, whatever that anybody that is not familiar at all with the City of Valparaiso's Parks and Recreation Department will want to ask. Tell us about the department. Give us an idea of also how it got started and been able to expand to where it is today.
We are celebrating our 76th year of operation as a department of the City of Valparaiso. Mm-hmm. The park board was formed in 1945. Our actual first park, Kirchhoff Park, was given to the city in 1917, but the actual development of a full-fledged park and recreation system was begun in 1945, and we had great hopes of having a grand celebration in 2020 of our 75th anniversary, and that actually, for all of the reasons of COVID restrictions, didn't occur, but we are planning on having a 75-plus-1 celebration in 2021. It's always been a partnership of our community leadership, our volunteers, tremendous board, a collaboration of our community in stewarding our open spaces, our community gathering spaces, our activities to serve each other, both from a young person standpoint of growing our kids in healthy ways, of nurturing our families, of providing activities for adults, and even into our senior adults to have a place to grow older well. And so this community has a long history of supporting parks, not only for good values and growing healthy, mm-hmm. but also as an economic development tool in that when people are choosing a place to live and choosing a place to work, a lot of times those decisions are made upon a good quality of life. And our economic development people, our real estate people, are always encouraging us and affirming that parks, because they're so visible, are a really important part of what that decision-making process comes down to. If all the other core things like public safety and tax structures are in good shape as well, but that tipping point can be those quality of life issues, schools and parks, and other services such as ours. And so we take that very seriously. We have a great team of people, devoted staff and volunteers. And so one of the most significant things I've seen and been expressed by some of our board leadership is that you could typically see downtowns and parks can be a leading indicator of the health and vibrancy of a community. If you see a downtown that is thriving and that is vibrant, that's an indication of a healthy community. If you see a park system that is thriving and vibrant, that's an indication of a healthy community. And so with that, we've had great support, and folks have continued to want to make our park system not only celebrate what has happened in the past for generations and create memories for folks that have been part of it in the past, and but to continue to make it better than ever.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me, John, if you obviously have a lot of people that visit all the parks, or maybe they have favorite parks in mind, and their family members, or they just as an individual may happen to visit a particular parks. What might be the, if you could say, the most popular, but certainly the best attended parks that are in Valparaiso these days?
Well, actually, we've got some data to support that, Chris, because mm-hmm. We're finishing up on our 5-year master plan, in which we actually survey both in a statistically valid survey, and then we also have an open line survey, and we had about 1,300 responses to that very question. And not surprisingly, our biggest signature parks had that greatest response. So our Central Park Plaza downtown, Rogers Lakewood, which is a 120-acre lakefront park on the north end of town, our Valparaiso fully accessible playground that was upgraded in 2014 that 3,000 volunteers helped build, our pathway systems Those bigger parks are Butterfly Playground in the north center of town. Our bigger facilities were the most popular. Actually, Rogers Lakewood had a significant resurgence in the year of 2020 of COVID. People were looking for socially distant places that they could get outside, and I think you saw that both in the National Lakeshore, the state parks, the county parks, and our natural setting parks. People were looking for that kind of experience. So they had a real resurgence of natural areas. But our urban settings continued to be popular as well, and they have been. And anything besides last year, when we couldn't have our large community gatherings, special events continue to be very popular with our patrons. And then places like Ogden Gardens that are places of natural beauty, and our horticulture department does a great job in settings in Ogden Botanical Gardens as well as areas throughout the city. So we try to provide a whole variety. And then our neighborhood parks, we have 19 properties, and those continue to be very popular as well. Something that we just opened last year at our Creekside Golf Course, adjacent to that, we have another Creekside Golf Course is 120 acres, but in addition to that, we have another 200 acres on that property. That was a great foresight by our foundation who helped us acquire that property. We worked with volunteers and created 6 miles of what are now called Creekside Trails, which is a mountain bike trail and a walking and jogging area as well. And that's been very popular. And then another facility that we opened last year, and because we were able to provide social distance, it was our Valparaiso Dog Park.
Yeah.
And we our goal was to have 300 members, and we're up to 700 members at that park as well.
Wow.
So variety of all sizes and diversity to try to meet the needs of a diverse population is what our goal has been.
Now, what kind of effort and maybe challenges, for that matter, too, has it been for the Parks and Recreation Department, your staff, and yourself to be able to keep all these parks up during the pandemic? Or actually, was it because it's so much outdoor work that it was maybe easier than it would be to take care of a building?
Well, certainly we were. It was safer because we were outside.
Right.
I wouldn't say it was easy. We still really needed to protect. The first thing was our highest priority was protect our staff and our customers. So following guidelines and learning protocols on how to protect them with PPE, although our first priority was to be respectful of those that were on the front lines in public safety and health care on those PPE going to those folks first. But we were able to get acquire the PPE that was necessary. So when you're cleaning restrooms, when you're dealing with any kind of public setting, we did not want to put any of our staff in jeopardy of their own health. Before we acquired the right procedures. And early on, in March of 2020, as things started to unfold, we really were diligent in finding the best practices that we could with our employees before we put them in a position to open up anything before we could understand what was the best practices to keep them safe. And then it was following, really, working very closely with the governor's orders and the state health department, and then very closely with the Porter County Health Department on the best ways to operate. But our goal with our staff was to try to still provide outlets for people to still connect with our facilities in a safe way, not to just shut them down. And to say the easy way out would be to just shut them down and to not have any access to them, but to come up with innovative ways, whether it was online concerts and other ways, where we could still reach them as best we could in ways that they hadn't been connected to us before, or to find modified ways that they could connect. And the golf course might be a real good example of that. Uh-huh. We opened the golf course in about four stages. I'm first not having the clubhouse open at all, to then just having the restrooms open on the clubhouse, and then moving forward to opening the clubhouse fully with masks. So, and first just not having any carts and no flagsticks, to having one cart per person, to then having carts with dividers, to now having full carts. And as a result of that, we started very slowly with golf, and then because golf became a really popular socially distanced activity, we had a record number of rounds. We had the best year of golf that we've had in 15 years.
Wow.
Last year.
That's great to hear.
Without any issues with staff or customers that we're aware of.
Now, John, as we go into the rest of 2021, what kind of programs, of course, making the changes you have to because of the pandemic, but just to keep people in Valparaiso, visitors as well as residents happy, what kinds of programs are you planning to go into during the warmer weather months?
Well, essentially, we've got all of our programs. Our activity guide is digital this mm-hmm. year rather than it's online at valparaisoparks.org. And because we need to be nimble and change, as the governor's orders just changed on April 6th, to essentially making masks a recommendation rather than a requirement, we are staying digital with our activity guide that lists everything that we offer, which are hundreds of activities, both indoors and outdoors, so that we can change and make those changes as they occur and that may need adjustments. Essentially, our activities go year-round, from
right.
ice skating. We just transitioned from ice skating at Central Park Plaza to our first warm weather event, which is a kids' active kids' day. All of our indoor activities, if you're renting the pavilion, the Butterfield Pavilion, or you're renting our welter room, or you're coming to visit our office, anything we have indoors, by working with the mayor and with the governor, we are still requiring masks indoors. Unless you're eating,
mm-hmm.
But we're still requiring masks indoors, but anything outdoors, so all of our sport activities, all of the golf, all of those games, unless you're in the clubhouse, masks are recommended, social distance is recommended, but they're not required. Our full gamut of things that were modified in 2020, where masks were still required outdoors if you were a spectator but not playing, that is now lifted because of vaccination prevalence, following the health guidelines that we are getting from the state and our Porter County Health Department. But indoors, they are still required. So we're back to 2019 levels on everything we're offering. The last thing I would add is our most vulnerable populations are seniors, and our Bonas Senior Center has been closed for a year, and we are working to get that open by the middle of May, and we're really excited about being able to do that. One of the biggest events we have is the 4th of July, where we have tens of thousands of people there. We are making plans, unless something changes, to have a full-blown 4th of July festival at Urschel Field across from the city post office, where we'll have 10,000 people.
That's what people in Valparaiso are hoping for. They certainly expect. They want to hear and find out, you know, the great events like that, to be sure. And before we go, let's be sure to mention the web address if people want to check out all the details and find out more. What's the way that people can find out about the Valparaiso Parks and Recreation Department?
ValpoParks.org, and we're on Facebook, and our office number is 219-462-5144. All of our youth sports are starting. We have a few openings left on that. All of our adult softball leagues, where we have 90 teams, we have a few slots left on that. Golf is going full bore. We're selling our passes for Rogers Lakewood, and mm-hmm. that had a banner year. Central Park Plaza, most of all our weekends are sold out there already, but
wow.
we still have a few openings left there. So really, we're back to 2019 levels on everything that we're doing, but still really promoting the CDC guidelines on social distance, masks recommended for outside activities, so still being careful, but they're not required. And if you're indoors, we still do require masks if you're going to do an indoor activity.
John Seibert is the Executive Director of the Valparaiso Parks and Recreation Department. And John, thank you for the great explanation of not only the park system itself, but all the great things that are going to be happening, even though COVID-19 is still an issue out there. Not going to let it keep the Parks and Recreation Department down. Thank you for being with us today.
Sure, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. America's child care industry virtually collapsed because of the pandemic. The Biden administration is responding with nearly $40 billion to address what the president's described as an acute, immediate child care crisis. So for parents that suspect that their preschooler may have had some meaningful learning loss because of the pandemic, how can they address and remedy the loss? Well, for that, we turn to veteran educator and language pathologist Holly De Leon to talk about it. And Holly, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
If you will, on a nationwide basis, how far behind are most youngsters because of COVID learning loss?
Yeah, you know, this interrupted learning, we think, depending on the study that you look at, it could be anywhere from 5 to 12 months that they've lost. And so the kids we're really worried about are the ones that were already behind before COVID.
Why seem to be important that preschoolers get caught up to whatever their appropriate developmental level is before they go into kindergarten?
And, you know, kindergarten is one of the first milestones that we measure, and so much of the foundation of learning happens before a child is 5. I think some people would be surprised to know that 90% of a child's brain is developed by the age of 5, and that's in response to the child's the early learning experiences that a child has had. So, of course, the quality of those learning experiences is critically important to that child's future development. Mm-hmm.
What are some of these common red flags, I guess, for a better term, to signal that a preschooler needs some special attention to help improve their skills?
Well, and, you know, we use in education, we use milestones, and I always put the caveat out there that milestones are just markers. And every child is on a continuum of learning, so you just want to make sure that they're progressing. But there are certain things that we are really mindful of right now, and really because of the trauma that COVID has brought within families. One is that we look for a child that has a significant speech delay. Sometimes the trauma can kind of halt things. So what you want to look at, a three-year-old should be able to be understood about 75% of the time by people in the family and outside the family. Mm-hmm. And so if they're still really not able to be understood, that's a red flag. And hand in glove with that goes language development. And that's how much language does a child understand and how much can they speak? And again, by the age of 3, we would like to see a child speaking about 200 words and understanding at least 1,000 words and speaking in connected, 3 to 4 words connected together in a sentence. So, you know, those are kind of on the speech and language side. On the mathematics side, what we look for is can a child see a pattern? Because, you know, math is just a logic, it's a series of logic. And so we do things with very young children like colored blocks, you know, red, blue, red, blue, red, and see whether the child can see what that pattern is and put the next block in place. And that's just games that parents can play with kids, you know, all the time. But one of the things that we're really worried about in education, and through no fault of, you know, families, but, you know, families have gotten pulled in a lot of different directions. And some parents having to try to hold down 2 and 3 jobs. And so what that has done is many times the children are hearing fewer words than they need to hear. A child, just normally developing child, should hear 21,000 words every day. And so if you didn't have enough time to sit down with your child to, you know, read to them and talk to them and have them hear those words, that child might have fallen behind. And we know from the studies that kiddos that get to kindergarten that have not heard enough the language, they will have a 30 million word gap by the time they get to kindergarten. Now, and that's hard mountain to climb.
Yeah. Are there a couple of things that parents could possibly do to help address some of these red flags?
Yeah, you know, I think, Chris, the main thing is just, you know, talk to them a lot. Tell them, you know, simple things. You're sitting there cooking dinner. Tell them what you're doing. You're stirring the meat, you know. I mean, just talk to them a lot. I can't overemphasize reading stories and nursery rhymes to them. Again, many parents might not know that nursery rhymes are critically important to very young children. And we know that a child by the age of four, if they can recite 8 nursery rhymes, have a really high predictor of reading success. So doing as much of that as you can possibly do when they're at this very young age.
Well, it sounds like there's at least something that parents can do. Quickly, can you tell us if these computer-assisted learning platforms are very helpful?
They are helpful, Chris, if they are done well. Unfortunately, there's some that aren't. I am working with one particular company because I like the quality of what they've done. It's called Animal Island Learning Adventure.
Uh-huh.
And what this does is, again, when the parent is not able to be there or the caregiver is not able to be there with the child, you still want that child to be exposed to academic vocabulary. And so that's what this Animal Island Learning Adventure does, is it's very engaging where the child is, you know, dancing and singing and lots of movement, but you're being exposed to academic vocabulary.
That's good to hear.
Stories, songs, things like that. So it can supplement what the parents or the caregiver is able to do.
Holly De Leon is a veteran educator and a language pathologist. She's told us about some of the learning loss red flags that parents should be aware of in their young ones, especially preschoolers, because of the pandemic. And Holly, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today.
You are quite welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy about what's happening in his city these days, as well as a conversation with Northwest Indiana native and author Brian Vukadinovich. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow.